Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. Don't adjust that dial. That's right. We're here. We're here at an off time. How's it going, Andrew Torres?
It's going great. I mean, you know, I haven't really stopped to breathe all weekend, but but it's fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yes, we wanted to record for you guys a special because the Supreme Court news, now, while it wasn't the worst possible news, there's still so much to talk about. So, and then we figured, you know, February is such a weird month. Somebody really screwed up making February. I don't know. I think I say this every year, but what calendar makers? What's going on with February? What's the deal? It's not one day shorter.
What's the deal with February?
Exactly. It's not one day shorter. It's like 3 days shorter than some months. I don't understand. So anyway, since it's normally a short month anyway, we figured we could squeeze in a bonus episode. And then, you know, we kind of were going back and forth, and we wanted to make sure that all our listeners would still get a bonus, even non-patrons. So we're gonna do the perfect compromise. We're going to split the child in half, and we're going to go half regular and then half bonus for patrons only. So that was our thinking, and we're coming to you on an off day as soon as we could get to you to record this. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I am too. I think there is a tremendous amount of misreporting going on regarding June Medical Services versus G, the case that we talked about in episode 251. We held back recording as long as we could, waiting for the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court finally issued a stay at 9:30 p.m. at night.
Yeah,
I got out some, you know, quick reaction over social media. But look, I know, you know, not everybody follows us on Twitter. Not everyone is a member of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, although you should. So I wanted to get out and
but they really are just messing with us at this point, right? I mean, we did a special thing. We're like, okay, we're gonna record the whole episode, and then we're gonna wait. We're gonna make poor Brian wait. You know, like we're gonna wait until, because gosh darn it, we're gonna wait until they do this thing, and then they just like pranked us. Okay, I have some questions for you. You know, I really want to. We'll see which half of the episode it gets into, but I want to talk Susan Collins because, of course, we were assured by Susan Collins that Kavanaugh would never, ever, you know, touch abortion rights because he has such a deep respect for precedent. So we're going to talk about that. But also, I'm curious, just from a process point of view, just a basic question, why would it go out that late? You know, like, what is there some explanation for that, or will we ever know? Or do they just they're all scribbling down their dissents as fast as they can, but they couldn't quite, you know, like why would it go out so late?
So I have to say that it is not uncommon for the Supreme Court in emergency cases to issue opinions and stays after the close of business, right? So, you know, if you think about it, right, where you have, you know, a decision that is handed down that's, you know, about to take effect tomorrow, or you have a stay in a capital case, you know, we're going to talk about that in next week's episodes. So sometimes the Supreme Court works after hours, but it seems weird in this case, because in this case, you had the situation where the Supreme Court a week ago Friday said, hey, we just got some pleading, so we're going to put in a 7-day stay until Thursday, February 7th. And then, you know, that'll give us time to read these papers and figure out, you know, where we're going to come down on this particular application for a stay. And they really shouldn't have been up against the clock.
Yeah, that's is it like, you know, Roberts was going back and forth to the last minute or something, you know, like couldn't decide.
It all of that obviously is speculation.
Yeah.
It is notable that the stay was granted, right, with Roberts joining the four sensible justices on the Supreme Court. The other four justices dissented, right, and said they would not grant a stay in this case. Only Justice Kavanaugh wrote separately to explain why he would grant a stay. And obviously, we're going to parse that dissent in great detail and try and figure out what that means. But I have to conclude that there was something weird going on that, you know, sort of kept the ball up in the air to the very, very last moment.
I think it's our show, right?
I'm sorry?
Mean, it's got to be our show.
It certainly could be our show. We know that various governmental entities have already shared secret FISA surveillance info and regarding opening arguments, and they delay their announcements until after we record.
Yeah, we're on Nixon's list of enemies. Trump's list of it. Yeah, somebody's.
Yeah. I wish I could do the Barney, like, hey, this is Richard Nixon's enemies list. Jane Fonda. I gotta think Jane Fonda loves the show, but who knows? I want to give you this piece of guidance to this episode, and that is that while granting the stay is certainly the least worst outcome, right? Like, it would be much, much worse if they had not granted the stay.
Right.
The fact that the ACLU and Newsweek and the New York Times have said that the Supreme Court blocks Louisiana abortion law from going into effect, that is, I mean, it's not true for most definitions of the word blocks. And the sort of sunny optimism, I think, is very, very much unwarranted.
Yeah, it's essentially like victory for a book, you know? That's what I'm seeing in different news media. It's is it fair to say it's like the Princess Bride where, you know, every day is like, oh, good night, good work, Wesley, sleep well, I'll most likely kill you in the morning. And then we're like cheering, yeah, we're not dead today. You know, it's like, that's not a victory, really. Is it like that?
That's not a bad analogy. I mean, to me, what it reminded me of was way back in January of 2017, right, when the first courts issued injunctions blocking the very first version of Trump's executive order on the Muslim ban. Right. And we said, hey, look, they haven't tackled this from the merits yet. And on the merits, and again, Trump's first EO was written so incredibly stupidly that it took a while for it to get into effect. But, you know, we said very consistently from the outset that Trump can do this. And so the news outlets saying, yay, there's nothing to worry about. See, like, it's not so bad. We told you that, you know, the courts would check against the worst of Trump's influences and impulses. And as we've learned, the answer to that was no. And I think if you are an abortion rights advocate, as we are, if you believe in constitutional government, as we do, then, it bite your fingernail, right? Like, this is, you should still be nervous and scared. It is still really, really bad. It's just not as terrible as it could have been. And that's great. But we're going to talk precisely about, you know, what's on the horizon in this case.
All right. Well, I shouldn't have said earlier I was excited, because, again, it's not exciting news. I'm just excited to be on the show again. You know, like, I love doing the show for everybody. So that part of it is what I'm excited about. In terms of the world, I'm not too excited about this, but at least it wasn't the worst possible outcome. So there's that.
Well, can I share something I'm really excited? Genuinely excited about. Yeah, I reached out to Julie Reichelman, who is the attorney with the Center for Reproductive Rights. She is the author of the petition for stay and the brief on the merits to the Supreme Court in this case. I invited her to come on the show, and she indicated that she's willing to come on the show. So we've got a schedule. We've got to get her on. But boy, I can't wait to talk to Julie Reichelman about this case.
That's exciting. Can't wait. Hope it happens. You never know. Scheduling is sometimes difficult, but We'll do our best to make. Well, rest assured, listeners, we'll do everything we can to make this happen.
Yeah.
All right. So, where do we want to go first?
So, let me give a little 30 seconds of background on what this case is. And
thank you, because it's always hard for us non-lawyers to remember. It's a stay of a thing that was not, you know, like which level of thing that it is. It's a stay of a stay of a ban of a. That kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So, Louisiana passed a bill It is called Act 620. That bill requires a physician to hold, quote, active admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of any facility where abortion is provided. That became part of the Louisiana Code, and that particular provision that was then immediately challenged in court by reproductive rights groups and by, in particular here, the June Medical Services Medical Center that provides abortion services. And the district court enjoined that act from going into effect. So this law has not gone into effect yet. The state of Louisiana then appealed up to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit reversed and said, there's no harm in, you know, letting this law go into effect. And then what we are looking at is the petition from June Medical Services to the Supreme Court to stay the Fifth Circuit's opinion, right? And
by the way, the Fifth Circuit opinion is like borderline malpractice. Like, any court in the world should have looked at this and been, oh, this is the same. This is it. I remember studying this. It's like the lecture that day in class was this exact fact pattern. And then you know, your homework is like this exact fact pattern. Any court that's not the Supreme Court should have been like, okay, I know this. Oh yeah, this can't work because we just had a case like this 5 minutes ago. And the Supreme Court said no.
Yeah. And, let's be clear, right? 5 minutes ago is 5 minutes ago in Supreme Court time, right? The previous case was a case called Whole Women's Health Services versus Hellerstedt, and it is from 2016.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that is literally an eye blink.
And as we all know, 2016 perpetually feels like for now. Like, I'll never forget 2016. Right. Really is like my reality currently.
Yeah, no, and Whole Women's Health Services tackled an identical law. There was a second law as well that was passed in Texas. And again, we've talked about this. There are these conservative groups that run around the country and propose model legislation. And when it passes in one state, they go to another state and get the exact same thing passed. So exact same bill, admitting privileges required within 30 miles of any facility that performs abortions. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-3 decision, 5-3 because Scalia was dead and Mitch McConnell was holding open that seat that was stolen by Neil Gorsuch, and Anthony Kennedy was the swing vote at the time. 5-3 decision, the Supreme Court said, yeah, no, that absolutely right. Constitutes an undue burden under the Planned Parenthood
so
versus Casey.
Fresh Supreme Court precedent. And so the Fifth Circuit would have failed TTTBE because they get a question that's, hey, you know, here's this exact fact pattern. This is this case that happened a minute ago. What do you think? And they failed TTP. I just want to say I think I'm doing better than the Fifth Circuit on TTTB. Can we say that?
Certainly on abortion questions, yes, you are.
Although
no, and probably in general.
Yeah.
So that's exactly right. Right. This should be a no-brainer. The fact that it was not a no-brainer and we were biting our nails until 9:30 p.m., a week extension late, right? Like, that's not a good sign. Other things that are really, really not a good sign is I mentioned that Whole Women's Health Services versus Hellerstedt was a 5-3 decision. The three votes on bottom were Alito, Thomas, and swing justice John Roberts. Right. So when we are talking about John Roberts and where he might, you know, break from the majority, it's important to remember he dissented in Whole Women's Health Services.
Oh, wow.
So and he's, you know, Donald Trump has added two hardline Republican activists. We don't need to go there. Right. He's added Gorsuch and Kavanaugh to the court, who both joined in the voting against. I should be clear on this. The four conservative justices minus John Roberts. So Alito, Thomas,
wow.
Kavanaugh. And
so
Gorsuch.
This really was a nail biter when it shouldn't have been.
Yeah. Those four would all have not granted the stay. Three of them declined to tell us why they would not grant the stay. And let's pause on that for a minute, right? Because the reason, the standards that govern whether you stay a judgment below, right, are very similar to the standards for injunctive relief, right? So in particular, you look at likelihood of success on the merits. And as you've pointed out, it's kind of hard to do better on likelihood of success on the merits than, you guys answered this question 2 years ago and you answered it my way, right? And you also look at the balance of the harms. And I think this is really, really important that, you know, we talked about this in episode 251. It is clear, right? Because these laws are pretextual. These accreditation laws are not passed by people who really want to make abortion facilities safer, want to make it like a better experience for the woman. Like, and I'm not just, you know, throwing shade on pro-life activists here. That they admit this sort of thing when they are trying to drum up votes back home, right? They say, hey, we're passing this because it's going to make it harder for women to get abortions.
Yeah.
Right. That's why they do it. And there was really no dispute over that in this case, such that the Fifth Circuit, while upholding this law and distinguishing whole women's health services, explicitly said that there was very little benefit in the record that could come out in terms of protecting women, or failed to identify really any benefit whatsoever to the state of Louisiana, other than and we read from the preamble to the Fifth Circuit's opinion in 251, other than saying Louisiana is an anti-abortion state. And they specifically mention that they have a statute that says if Roe v. Wade or abortion is determined not to be a constitutional right at the federal level, then they will immediately spring into place laws banning abortion to the extent that the law provides. Right. So even the Fifth Circuit says, come on, like, we know this isn't really about admitting privileges and keeping women safe. This is really just about making it harder for women to get abortions, making it harder for clinics to stay in operation, making it harder for doctors to get licensed to perform abortions under Louisiana state law. And so even if you were legitimately intending to strike down Act 620 here, right? Reverse that. Even if you were intending to effectively overrule Planned Parenthood versus Casey, right, and Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, mm-hmm. and say, yeah, you know what? Like, yep, we're gonna let Louisiana effectively regulate abortion out of existence within its borders, and we're not gonna call that an undue burden because of reasons, right? You might still come down in favor of the stay because the balance of the equities swings so far in the other direction. I mean, it's about as clear a case as you can possibly imagine, right? The Fifth Circuit has said doesn't hurt the state at all if the law is delayed, and it will radically change the facts on the ground for women. That those are the kinds of conditions under which you say, well, okay, then, regardless of where you're going to come out, let's stay the law and determine, which way. Exactly.
It's still based on you haven't changed. Even if you plan on changing the precedent, you haven't. So it seems this couldn't be more of a no-brainer. And it's amazing that these justices can not only dissent, but then, with the exception of Kavanaugh, be like, I don't have to tell anybody why. Just meh.
Kavanaugh did tell us, and I, as I said before we started recording, I cannot tell if this makes Kavanaugh an evil genius or an evil idiot. There are three parts of his dissent that I want to talk about. And the first part is,
well, before Kavanaugh's, we do that, can I set ahead. That up with the Susan Collins stuff?
Because, please do.
Yeah, because everybody knows Susan Collins assured us that Kavanaugh would has nothing but respect for precedent and would absolutely protect Roe v. Wade because she is not pro-life. She's pro-choice, but she was assured and she voted for Kavanaugh despite the fact that, you know, we are only a couple votes away from scuttling that appointment. You know, every Democrat but Joe Manchin voted against him, and Joe Manchin, I think, only voted for him because he could. I think he would have voted no if the no votes were there, but since they weren't, he did that strategically. But anyway, the point is, Collins was assured. I trust Kavanaugh. Look at him. Look at his face. Isn't he trustworthy? Isn't he a super trustworthy guy? When he gets up and yells and sniffles over and over when testifying in front of Congress. But anyway, so everyone is mad at Susan Collins right now for, I guess, being so gullible or being deliberately misleading. I don't know what. And then her response, her team's response was, oh, you people didn't even read Kavanaugh's dissent. And so that's where I stopped, because I was like, all right, I'm going to ask Andrew, is there something in this dissent that would make it such that Collins is still right, that he's going to protect abortion rights, yet he would have still not issued a stay in this case or whatever? How could you walk that tightrope? Because I'm pretty sure protecting abortion rights doesn't mean protecting abortion rights, oh, unless you have reasons. And then and then if you have reasons which you dissent with, then that's fine. That's not what I meant.
Yeah, so I have read Kavanaugh's dissent. It's only like a page and a half. We'll link it in the show notes. It is the exact opposite of what Susan Collins is claiming. I should add, by the way, Justin Walker leveled that exact same claim at me in our debate. Right, I said Brett Kavanaugh is going to shred precedent, and yeah, he scoffed and was like, "He wrote a book called The Law of Judicial Precedent." Like, sadly, Justin Walker didn't know that I had read this. It's a 942 page textbook. It is not fair to say Brett Kavanaugh wrote it, right? Like, it's 15 different judges who all have written a chapter in it, right? And Kavanaugh's chapter is about respecting vertical precedent when you sit on the DC circuit, right? So everything is, when the higher court tells you to do X, here's how I apply precedent. None of it is incompatible with, boy, when I get on the higher court, I can't wait to start, feeding things into the wood chipper. And this gives me no cause to think any differently on Brett Kavanaugh here. It is clear to me that Kavanaugh is itching to overturn Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Roe v. Wade. And he's trying a variety of different strategies here. And this is why I can't figure out if the rest of the court is going to go along with him, right? If this is, he's an evil genius, or then like they're mad at him for saying the quiet part loud by accident, right? So let's delve into the Kavanaugh dissent, right? There are three components that I think are really, really crucial here. The first is, and other Supreme Court lawyers, Andrew Seidel has talked about this on our show, part of the battle at the Supreme Court is to rewrite facts without acknowledging that you're rewriting the facts. Mm-hmm. And what Kavanaugh does here at the beginning of his dissent is say in sort of blasé English things that are really, really astonishing, right? So here's his opening paragraph, right? I'm going to skip a little bit of the intro stuff, but he says, "The Fifth Circuit rejected the plaintiff's facial challenge based on that court's factual prediction that the new law would not affect the availability of abortions from, as relevant here, the four doctors who currently perform abortions at Louisiana's three abortion clinics. In particular, the Fifth Circuit determined that the four doctors likely could obtain admitting privileges." It doesn't say under the law, but that's what that means, right? That's an astonishing thing to say, because it does not acknowledge, in the context of determining whether to stay the Fifth Circuit's opinion, that the Fifth Circuit reversed the factual holdings of the district court, right? That's absolutely one of the things you want to know in deciding, hey, should we let the Fifth Circuit go into effect or not, knowing they did a thing that appellate courts pretty much never, ever do, is a really crucial thing to omit. And again, this falls on the clever side of the ledger for me, right? It's something that is hard to explain unless you're an OA listener and you know, you've been following along and you know that the district court's job is to find facts. The appellate court's job is to apply the law. And so you have an incredibly high standard for the court to reverse the factual determinations of the district court below. And look, like, that makes total sense once you've been immersed in the legal system, right? Because the district court is the one that holds the trial, right? Like, that's where the witnesses testify.
Yeah.
You know, and the judge gets to see, and you know, what you have at the appellate court level is you have the trial transcripts, you have the documents, right? You have the entire file from below. But you know what you don't have is you don't know when a witness got on the stand and was sweating profusely, right? And I'm 100% serious about that, right? Like, this is the classic example of what you argue. Because, you know, look, I've argued on appeal to the Fourth Circuit and to other various circuit courts of appeal. And when you're defending the factual determinations below, right, that's the classic example I have used in open court to say, Your Honor, you know, this court has no idea if the witness was sweating, mumbling, breaking his glasses in half, right? Like, the judge, the finder of fact, the judge, and if there was a jury, the jury got to see that. And their decision goes into and incorporates all of those circumstances, right? And for the appellate court to come in and second guess that, like, you've got to have really, really strong reasons. Now, again, I'm not saying that district courts are inviolate, right? I'm not saying that you can't overturn it. And certainly when there are plain errors of fact, right? Somebody says, oh, Milwaukee is located in North Carolina, right? Like, sure, you can reverse those kinds of plain errors. But to go back and say, well, we know that the trial court determined that these doctors would not get admitting privileges, but we're pretty sure they would.
Wow.
That's an astonishing thing to say. And then for you to lead with that as Brett Kavanaugh. So that's kind of point one, rewriting the facts. Point two, now we're delving a little more deeply into the law that Brett Kavanaugh goes after here. And this requires us to understand the difference between a facial challenge to a statute and an as-applied challenge. And the distinction is totally common sense, right? When a law is facially invalid, that means the law as written, regardless of how it's implemented, violates your constitutional rights, right? If I passed a law that said, only MSNBC, transcripts can be cited as evidence of the news in judicial proceedings, then that you wouldn't have to wait to see, you know, what those transcripts look. You'd be like, oh, come on, right? Like, it you would say, hey, look, we know what this law is meant to do, right? It's meant to say that liberal opinion shows will constitute the only thing that you can cite in court. And notice there, and so that would be a facial challenge, right? You wouldn't have to wait to find out. And notice, by the way, that this is going to be important, a facial challenge still requires you to know some facts about the world, right? Like, my facial challenge to the MSNBC law requires you to know that MSNBC, particularly after 7 p.m. at night, has a left-wing slant, right? That it has liberal opinion columnists who get on. I happen to think their reporting during the day is, mostly neutral, but other people might disagree, but you know, it's clear, right? Like, you would take that into account, and then you would say, on face, this violates the First Amendment because this is going to be viewpoint discrimination, right? An as-applied challenge might work if, instead of I pass a law that says you can only cite MSNBC in court transcripts, suppose I pass a law that says all court transcripts have to be signed off by the official archivist, and the archivist will submit those papers and I go through a lengthy set of bureaucratic privileges that, like, on face, doesn't seem to be the same as MSNBC, right? But
then you look at how it's applied and it turns out it's always going a certain direction kind of thing.
Yep. That is exactly right. You know, it turns out the archivist that was appointed is a, you know, MAGA
Mr. MBC or MSA.
Right. Yeah. Or right. Yeah. Or right. Or is, yeah, the archivist is Rachel Maddow. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
let's stick. Let's keep sticking it to our own side. Right. Then you would raise, right, an as applied challenge, and you would say, yeah, you know what? Like, perfectly fine to say that that court testimony has to be signed off on. But this law, as it's doing it, is being applied in a way that is viewpoint discrimination. And then and notice that these two principles overlap substantially. This is going to be important. Put a pin in this one. You can bring as applied evidence to then support your facial challenge, right? You can seek facial relief. Mm. And the way in which you do that is you say, let's stick with our same law. You say, look, we suspected when the legislature passed this archivist bill that it was going to be used to politically dominate the courts. And we didn't have evidence at the time, but now, right, we've seen how it's gone into practice. So this court should use the actual as applied workings to strike down the whole law on face, right? Because the problem is that you've got a person who's an archivist who now gets to decide, does this come in? And yes, the archivist is Rachel Maddow right now, but replacing Rachel Maddow with somebody else isn't going to solve the problem, right? It's still going to be a problem because that next person will have a political bias, and maybe it won't be Rachel Maddow's political bias. Maybe it'll be Sean Hannity, right? Like, who knows? Just strike down the whole law. We thought it was bad. Now we've got some evidence and we know it's bad. Make sense?
Yep.
Yep. So the second part about Kavanaugh's opinion is that he wants to convert. Part of the reason that he wants the stay to go into effect is he wants the law to take effect, and he wants to convert this from a facial challenge to an as-applied challenge. And the reason to want to do that is really, really obvious, because a facial challenge says, yeah, these laws are wrong. By the way, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, we're going to talk about this a little bit more in the bonus content. That was a facial challenge, right? There are wrinkles to that. And again, we'll go into it when we do the deep dive. But he wants to rewrite the history of Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt such that these laws then are not presumptively invalid, but that they can say, oh, look, like, it was just invalid here because of the fact specific as applied challenge. So perfectly OK to craft a law and give it another try. So keep in mind, that's his goal. Here's what he says. And to do this is just, I should say, shocking, but nothing shocks me anymore. But see if you can spot the duplicity.
Okay.
Kavanaugh says, the law has not taken effect, so the case comes to us in the context of a pre-enforcement facial challenge. This means that the parties have offered, in essence, competing predictions about whether doctors can obtain admitting privileges under the law. The district court concluded that the doctors likely could not obtain admitting privileges, therefore enjoined the law. The Fifth Circuit concluded that they likely could obtain admitting privileges and therefore lifted the injunction. Before us, the case largely turns on the factual question of whether these doctors can obtain admitting privileges. If we denied the stay, that question could readily and quickly be answered without disturbing the status quo or causing harm to the parties or the affected women, because the state's regulation provides that there will be a 45-day regulatory transition period before the new law is applied. The state represents, however, moreover, that Louisiana will not move aggressively to enforce the challenge law during the transition period, and further represents that the abortion providers will not immediately be forced to cease operations. Louisiana's regulation, together with its express representations to this court, is conclude that even without admitting privileges, these doctors will be able to perform abortions at the clinics during the 45-day transition period, and then both the doctors and the relevant hospitals could act expeditiously and in good faith to reach a definitive conclusion about whether they can obtain admitting privileges. Did you?
There's a lot there that I hate, but yeah, it's like he's just turning it into, like you said, I'm glad you explained the facial versus as applied challenge, because he's just converting it into that. It seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like if we already have strong, you know, 2 year old, still fresh, like barely even the ink is barely dried on this precedent, that a law like this is facially invalid unconstitutional, right? Isn't that what we, okay. Mm-hmm. It would seem then that no amount of facts about how a law, the same law, will be applied somewhere would make any difference, right? But he's turning it into like, no, if we need to let it go into effect so we can see how it shakes out. And then that'll be the ultimate question. He's just pretending that that was somehow the question the whole time.
So that's exactly right. And and thank you for setting me up, because it's even more pernicious than that.
Geez.
Right. So you got all that. Also, you might notice this, you know, 45-day transition period thing.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk about that in the initial application.
Well, is he basically saying like, oh, it's okay, there's no great harm because you'll have 45 days until women have no rights. So, you know, there's
look, like, let's be fair, right? I want to steel man this position, right?
Okay.
So Kavanaugh's position as steel man is, look, the law, if we lift the stay, the law goes into effect. That triggers this 45-day period. You'll have those 45 days to apply for your privileges. And if you don't get your privileges within the 45 days, well, then you can just run back to the district court and get another injunction, right? And you'll be able to challenge the law as applied and say, hey, look, exactly what I said was going to happen just happened. I didn't get my privileges, therefore block this law from going into effect, right? That's the steel man part of the argument. There are two problems with the steel man part of the argument. The first is that this entire 45-day thing, the reason we didn't talk about this when we first covered the case in episode 249 is because it didn't exist in episode 249. It was, and here I'm going to read from the reply brief filed by June Medical Services. Quote, just prior to filing its objection to the stay position, to the stay petition, Louisiana hastily posted to the internet a one-page notice outlining a 45-day procedure that it purportedly intends to use to verify that abortion clinics have provided with Act 620. This notice does nothing to mitigate the harms. According to the notice, clinics will have 45 days to submit documentation that they have complied with the act, and they will then proceed to verify that the physicians have admitting privileges that meet the law's requirements. So, stop and sidebar. This is not part of the law. This is just a thing they made up after filing their objection.
Like to try to soften it a little bit.
To say, you don't need to do a... We promise. We pretty definitely extra pinky swear promise. We're not really going to do this right away.
Wow.
Notice number two, that it doesn't say what Kavanaugh says it says, right? It says that during that 45-day period, you have 45 days, not for the doctors to get the privileges, but for the clinics to submit documentation, and then the state will evaluate the status of that documentation, right? But it's even worse than that, as the brief continues. Even if Louisiana adheres to this verification process, liability for violating the act, which includes civil liability for clinics, as well as civil, criminal, and professional liability for the physicians, is triggered as soon as the mandate issues and the act is no longer enjoined. Nothing in the notice suggests otherwise. Given the number and the severity of the law's penalties, no clinic or doctor without admitting privileges will continue to provide abortions once the act becomes enforceable. Irreparable harm to women in Louisiana is therefore imminent. That's why I said on Thursday, as we recorded, that if the law was not blocked, that clinics would close down on Friday. I continue to believe that. This, and the reason I believe that was because I read this reply brief, right? Kavanaugh has read this reply brief. So has everybody else on the Supreme Court. To not address the fact that this 45-day period is a sham that does not completely cover the problem anyway, I think tells you everything you need to know. About Brett Kavanaugh. So, when Susan Collins says, have you even read the dissent? Yes, Senator Collins, I have read the dissent. It gets worse. I hasten to say that. It actually does get worse.
Wow.
And this,
well, as
this
the
is
fun police,
be, yeah.
I've got to say, we're over halftime. Do we need to convert over to patron only yet? Sorry, I'm the fun police. What do you think?
Yeah, let's. This is going to be a really, really good deep dive on res judicata, on claim preclusion, and what Kavanaugh's endgame here, because it's totally nefarious. And I think it's not hard to unpack when you follow it, but it's gonna take a while. You know me, it's gonna take a while to unpack. So let's head on over to the bonus.
All right, everybody. Well, you heard the man. Patreon.com/law. We just want to make sure that our patrons are more depressed than the general public. So that's what we're doing here.
And this is we're gonna do this for all of our patrons, right? Everybody.
Oh yeah, yeah. Any level. Yep. Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess we can sign out this regular section by saying thanks for listening. And this is why we needed to vote for the Democrat 2016. And if you care about women's rights, if you care about gay rights, if you care about just people's rights, which seem like a good thing to care about, we need to stop thinking in terms of like some nonsense, you know, political speeches that someone got paid for or something, you know, like stuff like that that's going to have almost no effect on us, and start thinking in terms of the court, which is the main thing that's going to have an effect on us, because Congress is broken anyway, so it's not as though it's highly likely that will matter. So that's what I think. I mean, this is we're seeing the very consequences that Hillary and that Andrew at the time, everybody said was going to happen, and we're seeing it. So
yeah, can I give 30 seconds on that?
Sure.
Because Liz Warren gave a beautiful and rousing and wonderful speech on Saturday, and I am already seeing from contingents that I respect and contingents that I don't, which include Michael Avenatti, the like, oh, well, you know.
Michael Avenatti is back. He's come out of his hiding place?
Yeah, he came out of his hiding and having to pay $300,000 for you know, filing a ridiculous defamation claim against Donald Trump. Look, it's hard to defame Donald Trump, right? anyway, I should let me be clear on that. That was not a defamation claim, but a slap, right? A claim alleging defamation. But again, we told you at the time it was ill-founded. Michael Avenatti came out to say, well, you know, I love Elizabeth Warren, but she has no chance strategically of beating Donald Trump. And I have mm-hmm. seen other less stupid sources say the same thing. I'll just go on that. Like, you have no idea, right? Like, strategic considerations in 2019 for who is the strongest general election candidate are by definition ill-informed. And in particular, if you think because of the like Pocahontas crap that makes Elizabeth Warren the weakest general election candidate, I would say the inference is the exact opposite, right? Like the ones you attack early on are the candidates that you fear the most. I retweeted out from our account, Seth Abramson, that noted how Fox News had framed Elizabeth Warren's speech to include the teleprompters in the camera field of vision. I mean, just a Bush League move to kind of say, oh, see, she's reading off the teleprompter. As if Donald Trump doesn't deliver every speech reading off of a teleprompter. I mean, yeah, look, we
you
went
can
through
tell
this with
pretty
Obama.
Easily when he's reading from a teleprompter and when he's not. He can't finish a sentence when he isn't
right.
without branching off to 47 different unrelated things that are like compliments he's giving himself.
it would be similarly Bush League for MSNBC to only show Republican candidates reading off of a teleprompter and show Democrats, you know, face on square. And anyway, I'm off on a tangent about Liz Warren, but I was definitely a little bit disappointed when we got some of the like, well, I don't know if she's going to, you know, look.
No,
look.
What you do is you pick the candidate you like best because that signals that you like that candidate. You don't mm-hmm. we don't need to be voting based on like, well, this is clearly the best candidate for me, but like, I don't think they'll win in the general. No, just you vote who you think's going to win.
Let's not tear down our Democratic candidates now, right?
Yeah.
Let's wait until there's a primary. And then, right, have a legitimate debate back and forth over what their policy positions are and what the Democratic Party stands for, right? That is, you know, that's 100% fair. And look, you and I did that, right? You know, it played out a lot on the predecessor show to Serious Inquiries Only. But, you know, you were a Bernie guy in the primaries. I was a Hillary guy in the primaries. And that, I thought that debate was healthy, right? I thought it is perfectly valid to say, you know, where do you want to come out? I want to see that again. We are going to have a robust primary. But, like, let's not play into the right's talking points right now by, like, smearing each other's non-preferred candidates on, you know, garbage stuff. Anyway.
All right. Well, and I like final note for the everybody here. When you say Fox, you know, you only key in on the people you're actually afraid of. Ooh, they must really be afraid of AOC. They're already they're starting early and often.
Oh, God.
For the 2032 election, whatever it would be. So yeah, they must really be afraid of her. Okay.
Liz Warren is still my number one crush, but AOC is number two with a bullet. So,
all right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and hop on over to Patreon. Try it out. Lots of good stuff for you there, including a nice bonus extra here. So see you over there. Are they gone? Okay, patrons.
Yeah.
It's just you and I.
It's just us.
We can, Andrew, if you want, you can really unload with the curse words on this one, I think.
Oh, yeah. We can make fun
damn
of the fucking normies,
Kavanaugh.
Too. Yeah. So I wanted to do this and I really think it's, I think you guys sticking around here are going to enjoy this.
First off, a little trash talking of the non-patrons. Ugh, those people.
Oh,
right?
My God, they're the worst. No.
Surely this home crowd will be on my side.
we absolutely love doing the show for normies.
For everybody.
You know, we get, like, look, there are a ton of law students, single moms, people can't support. We love them. Anyway, all right, enough pandering to the people who aren't listening. Now let's pander to the ones who are. When we last left this episode, I was talking about the facial versus as applied challenge and converting that what Kavanaugh wants to do is convert this from a facial challenge to an as applied challenge. And he's like, what could the harm possibly? Let's uncover the evidence. And here's what he says, right? He says, if the doctors, after good faith efforts during the 45-day period, and again, that's not what the 45-day period is, but let's assume that it is, right, for purposes of steelmanning his argument, cannot obtain admitting privileges, then the Fifth Circuit's factual predictions, which were made in the context of a pre-enforcement facial challenge, could turn out to be inaccurate as applied. Right? Again, look at that sentence, right? Like, that sentence says, the problem is not the problem with the law, the problem is with the implementation of the law, right? So already we're talking about...
you pass a law that's like, hey, no talking. And the Supreme Court in 2016 is like, yeah, that's unconstitutional. And then they passed it in 2018 or 19, you're like, let's try this no talking law again. And then, you know, beer loving, it's the patron show, Dickweed, Brett Kavanaugh is like, hold on. What if the no talking law actually, when we pass it, it's fine. You don't know. And it's like, no, yeah. That's not how it works.
It's even more nefarious than that. So I'll try and unpack it. So then he says, if that turns out to be the case, then even the state acknowledges that the law as applied might be deemed to impose an undue burden for purposes of whole women's health. In that circumstance, the plaintiffs could file an as applied complaint or motion for preliminary injunction in the district court, and the district court could consider whole woman's health as to whether to enter a preliminary or permanent injunction. So there are a couple of things immediately that come to mind here, right? The first is the classic. We've talked about this whenever abortion restrictions are at issue. The game plan for those who oppose abortion is to run out the clock, right? Because the longer you can force women to have to wait.
Yeah.
The easier it is to be like, oh, well, look, like, we would have let you get an abortion, but, you know, you're now 7 months pregnant. Too bad. The other thing is, think about, right, how this works in practice. So there can be three things here, right? So number one is run out the clock. Number two, let's think about the implications of this, right? So we convert your claim here from a facial challenge to, no, well, look, just wait, see if your doctor doesn't get privileges, then bring an as-applied challenge, and then get an injunction from the district court. Where would that district court injunction go? You guessed it, back up to the Fifth Circuit. And we know what the Fifth Circuit is going to do. They did this in Whole Woman's Health. I mean, we didn't say this in the main show. We said this in 249 and 251. Whole Woman's Health, Texas, next door to Louisiana, Texas and Louisiana are both in the Fifth Circuit, right? So this is not just a case of it's the same law. It is the same law going through the same court, having been overruled by the Supreme Court and reversed 2 years ago, going, well, you know, we think maybe there's something a little different about the Supreme Court in 2019 than there was in 2016. I wonder what that is, right? And obviously what that is we've had two hardcore right-wing judicial activists appointed to it. There's a third thing, and this is going to require a little bit of unpacking, and we have to turn back to the Whole Woman's Health decision. In that case, as I said in the main show, we had the exact same law regarding admitting privileges. And that law took kind of a weird path up to the Supreme Court. So I'm going to walk you through the facts a little bit. I promise you this will pay off when it gets there, but it's important to establish kind of the background conditions. So Texas passed the same law. It was called House Bill 2 in Texas in July of 2013. But it had a ramp up period, right? And so in September, before the law took effect, a group of Texas abortion providers did exactly what Kavanaugh said they should do, right? Went to the district court and said, we are filing a facial challenge to the validity of House Bill 2. And then the district court, literally a couple of weeks later, granted the injunction. Then it went up to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit in 3 days, right? Like really a kind of a remarkable turnaround, right? The kind of turnaround you typically only see in, you know, capital cases when the person is about to be executed. 3 days later, the Fifth Circuit vacated the injunction and permitted the law, House Bill 2, to go into effect. And they took up the case on the merits and they validated the law on the merits. And so while that was pending, right, the law actually went into effect. A week after the Fifth Circuit, right? I mean, again, as quickly as possible as it is to write up a Supreme Court cert petition, right? Like these things, you got to get the law right and research. Like to write a Supreme Court cert petition in a week is a heroic challenge, right? I could not do one in a week. I could hire a couple of additional lawyers to sort of farm out the research, and maybe if I didn't sleep for that week, maybe get it out. But plaintiffs had a big law firm. They cranked out a cert petition in a week, and that was denied. And then they also, in the same week, filed a second challenge in district court. Right. So, Fifth Circuit says injunction's going into injunction is lifted. House Bill 2 is going to go into effect in Texas, and then they bring. Now they bring an as-applied challenge, right? They say, look, the law just went into effect. We've had all these developments, and they filed the lawsuit in district court, got an injunction, which was then overturned by the Fifth Circuit again. That's what the Supreme Court then stayed the Fifth Circuit's decision and took up the case on the merits, and that's what became Whole Woman's Health. OK, Okay. The crucial point, and I need to go back because I think I misstated the factual history a little bit because it's super confusing. So basically, you had two cases in Whole Woman's Health. The first was the facial challenge. That was blocked by the Fifth Circuit, right? Denied by the Fifth Circuit, which vacated the injunction and said, yep, law can go into effect, and then ruled on the merits. And by the way, the law is totally fine. The plaintiffs in that first case did not petition to the Supreme Court at the time. The reason they did not petition to the Supreme Court was because at that time, the composition, Antonin Scalia was still alive. The composition of the Supreme Court didn't look very good. And the Fifth Circuit had decided that you didn't have sufficient factual proof. So what they said was, you know what, we're not going to petition in this case. We're going to let the law go into effect for a week. And then we're going to show via an as-applied challenge seeking facial relief, right? Just like I talked about in the main segment, that the law is indeed going to shut down, you know, half or more of the abortion clinics in the state of Texas, that it's obviously an undue burden. And that's what they did, right? So strategic decision to not continue to pursue the facial challenge minus the evidence in the Supreme Court to sit back and wait, right? And again, they only waited a week, not a long time. That was the first question that the Supreme Court had to consider in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, was the question of standing. And in particular here, the question of res judicata. And that is, did the plaintiffs lack the ability to bring the second case, the as-applied challenge seeking facial relief, because they didn't petition the Supreme Court for review of the Fifth Circuit's ruling in the first case? Does that make sense?
I don't know. Patrons, does that make sense? I don't know. It's a little convoluted.
It's super dense, but again, let me try and go back and get, because this is really, really crucial to understand.
Okay.
So they said the abortion providers filed the lawsuit and said, we think this discriminates against women. We think that this violates the constitutional stand. Excuse me. We think that this violates the constitutional standard of Planned Parenthood versus Casey by constituting an undue burden on a woman's right to get an abortion by imposing this admitting privileges requirement.
All right.
Right. That went all the way up, that they won at the district court level, lost at the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit said, well, you don't have any proof of that. Okay. Rather than petition for cert, rather than appeal to the Supreme Court, they were like, fine, let the law go into effect. They let the law go into effect for a week. And then after a week, they had a whole bunch of facts, right?
Yeah.
And then they moved back to the district court to get an injunction. And the district court said, yep, for all of the reasons that we granted you an injunction in the first place as a facial challenge, and also you got a lot of new evidence.
And by the way, kudos to this district court. They seem to perpetually be on the right side of things here.
It's shockingly, like, even in conservative areas, district courts are, and this is that's a really great sidebar to go down. Like, it's difficult to be an activist at the district court level. And the reason is because if every district court justice, every district court judge wants to be an appellate court judge, and every appellate court judge wants to be on the Supreme Court, right? Maybe, you know, there are probably a handful of exceptions. But if you're at the district court, you are bound. You're at a district court in Texas or Louisiana. You're bound by what the Fifth Circuit says, and you're bound by what the Supreme Court says. So you can't just go off the reservation. District court judges, by and large, and again, Trump's appointees are a dangerous departure from this, but by and large, even regardless of your political beliefs, you're more constrained to follow the law and to follow precedent, because you don't want to be known as, oh, yeah, that's, you know, Judge Torres gets reversed all the time. Right. And there are some judges that have that reputation. And when you have that reputation, that's the first thing that comes out when there's a question of whether to elevate you to the, mm-hmm. you know, to the Fourth Circuit, right? So, yeah. So district court judges tend to apply the law. That's why the district court is getting it right over and over again here.
Yeah, so weird.
So that's what happens. Second case, district court grants the injunction. Fifth Circuit reverses again. And this time, now, plaintiffs have no choice. They've got to go to the Supreme Court. And they go to the Supreme Court. And fortunately, the Supreme Court rules 5-3 that in light of the new evidence, which includes the as-applied evidence, that the statute is still facially unconstitutional. Right. And remember, I made that distinction in the main show. Right? And this is not an uncommon thing.
I was going to ask, in light of these new facts that you're giving us, they still said it was facially unconstitutional and not
yes.
just because of the application?
Yes, that's exactly right. In other words, yeah, we had our suspicions that when you put in reporting requirements and admitting privileges, that was going to be used to unduly burden women. And we can take judicial notice of the fact that, in fact, it did unduly burden women. Mm-hmm. So they struck down the law as unconstitutional. They didn't say, well, go back and figure out a way to do the privileges that they said, no, look, like the statute's invalid, right? Okay. That's what Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt stands for, that particular 30-mile requirement for admitting privileges is a violation of the undue burden standard in Casey. That's why this case is so galling, right? Now, this is the key part in which I can't decide. Kavanaugh thinks he's being clever. I can't decide if he's being actually clever or if he's an idiot. But he's definitely like, you know, in the lair, tenting his fingers together, getting ready to, you know, summon the killer robots. Before in the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt decision, before the court ruled on the merits, they ruled on a question of standing. We've talked about standing before, right? Standing usually means one of two things. It either means, are you the person who was injured, right? You know, you can't bring a lawsuit on behalf of somebody else, right? That's why Jill Stein couldn't sue for a recount in Wisconsin on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton had to be the party who was aggrieved, right? Or it can mean, do you have a live case or controversy, right? I can't go forward with a speculative complaint. Those are the two main ways in which standing comes up, but there are other subsidiary doctrines that implicate standing. And this one here is a doctrine called res judicata. Res judicata, in particular.
I've heard of this.
Yes. Yeah.
But I couldn't tell you what it means.
Well, I'm going to tell you. So it includes an aspect called claim preclusion. And what claim preclusion says is, once you get a determination on the merits of your claim, you can't sue again, right? You can't keep taking another bite at the apple. And that makes total sense, right? If I sue you for breach of contract and then we exhaust the appeals and we're done and the courts say, no, you know what? Thomas didn't breach his contract. When we're done.
Wait, is this the civil version of double jeopardy? Kind of?
Yeah, it is exactly right. It is the civil version of double jeopardy. That is the best way to think about it, right? You wouldn't want me to then be like, okay, well, I won. Well, congratulations. I'm going to sue you tomorrow for breach of the same contract, right?
Yeah.
Because I would clearly just be, you know, using the system vexatiously at that point to keep you in court. There's another aspect of that, right, which is it would be similarly a violation of res judicata, and there would be additional wrinkles on this. Suppose I went to bring the same lawsuit against you in six different courts, right? Like, and then I see how's it going in each of these six courts, right? And then I forum shop for the one where it's going the best, right? There are lots of different reasons why we don't let people continue successively to litigate the same claim. Right.
Yeah.
And the argument that was made by the state of Texas was, oh, no, look, that's what these people are doing, right? They sued us once. They got a result they didn't like from the Fifth Circuit. Then they went down and, yeah, no, they called it as applied. But this is the exact same claim. And don't let them come back up here and litigate it again. And fortunately, the five-justice majority said, no, like, that's not the way this works. If the facts on the ground change, then it's no longer the same claim, right? And this makes total sense. As the majority says in Whole Woman's Health, development of new material facts can mean that a new case and an otherwise similar previous case do not present the same claim. And then, quoting from the restatement, they say, where important human values, such as the lawfulness of continuing personal disability or restraint, and similarly, the availability of an abortion, are at stake, even a slight change of circumstances may afford a sufficient basis for concluding that a second action may be brought. And then this is Judge Kennedy's opinion. He does something that I really, really like that is going to be increasingly rare in our Supreme Court in coming years. He makes an analogy with no citations as to the fairness of that restatement rule. He's like, okay, so I just quoted from there, and it's really an opening arguments kind of thing to do. He's like, okay, I just quoted from the restatement, but here's what this means in practicality. And here's what Kennedy says. We find this approach persuasive. Imagine a group of prisoners who claim that they're being forced to drink contaminated water. The prisoners file suit against the facility where they're incarcerated. If at first their suit is dismissed because a court does not believe the harm would be severe enough to be unconstitutional, it would make no sense to prevent the same prisoners from bringing a later suit if time and experience eventually showed that prisoners were dying from contaminated water. Such circumstances would give rise to a new claim that the prisoner's treatment violates the Constitution. Factual developments may show that constitutional harm, which seemed too remote or speculative at the time of the earlier suit, is in fact indisputable. In our view, such changed circumstances will give rise to a new constitutional claim. This approach is sensible, and it is consistent with our precedent. And he goes on to cite a couple of cases, one from 1931, that are shoehorn. I mean, I want to be honest here, that are sort of shoehorning in the precedent, right? There are no case that says that up until Hellerstedt, but it's a totally sensible thing to say, right? I do not need to tell you, Hellerstedt was a 5-3 decision. And the dissent, signed on to by Alito, Thomas, and Chief Justice Roberts, would have denied the appeal on the grounds of res judicata.
Wow.
Here's what the appeal says. Here, all the elements are easily satisfied from the prior case. That case, one, was brought by a group of plaintiffs that included the petitioners in this case. Two, asserted the same cause of action or claim. Three, was adjudicated by courts of competent jurisdiction. Four, was decided on the merits. Five, resulted in the entry of a final judgment. And six, was not otherwise subject to invalidation. So they would have said, no, too bad, get out. And I believe that the nefarious part of what Kavanaugh lays out is precisely that. In other words, Kavanaugh says, hey, let's issue the stay. And then if you don't like it and the facts really are changed, you can go back and get an injunction. Hey, bring an as-applied challenge
and then
later.
And they'll say, ah, oh, this is, we've already tried this claim.
And then on a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court will affirm the lower court. And John Roberts, again, if you believe the evil genius theory, John Roberts will write an opinion that says, look, we are in no way ruling on the merits of the Fifth Circuit, which is basically overruling Roe v. Wade in the state of Louisiana. But all we're saying is that the plaintiffs lack standing in this particular case. We're just without the power to consider that. We really would. We would look at it. But sorry, you tried once. Ugh. And then now it's too late to take another bite at the apple. You are barred by res judicata. I find it slightly heartening that nobody else signed on to Kavanaugh's dissent. But I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if that is Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch saying, we disagree with this, or them going, ixnay on the, you said the quiet part loud again, Brett. Mm. Like you were supposed to keep quiet on this, yeah, so that we could, yeah. But I think the takeaway is, right, we've talked about how the thesis, right, and Justice Chief Justice Roberts signing on to the grant of the stay in this case is some evidence for the institutional thesis, right? And that is the idea that John Roberts values the idea that 30 years from now, kids taking AP US history will not look back at the Supreme Court that bears his name and have it be held up in ignominy as the most activist court of the last 100 years, right? That he wants to maintain institutional respect for the Supreme Court. I don't know. Again, we have very little evidence to test the robustness of that thesis. But one of the things that if in fact the fact that people are talking about it certainly means that the hardcore activists on the Supreme Court are also aware of it. And so if you are aware of it, part of how you evade the notions of this is going to bring institutional ill repute to the Supreme Court is to say, oh, come on, you can do this because this is just going to be a procedural question. This is just going to be an issue of standing. This is just going to be tech. This isn't like a decision that says we hereby overrule Roe v. Wade. Right. This isn't like a decision that says we hereby overrule Obergefell versus Hodges. You can sign on to this one. And I suspect that we are going to see that from litigants and from the hardest core activist contingent of the Supreme Court in increasing frequency to try and have Roberts do. And let's be clear on this, what he wants to do. Right. Roberts dissented in Hellerstedt. Right. Roberts dissented vociferously in Obergefell. Right. He is in no way a fan of those decisions. And so the question is, you know, does he view this as will he view procedural issues as giving him license to do what he wants to do? Like, let's not lose sight of the fact, like John Roberts wants to overturn Roe v. Wade. He wants to overturn Obergefell versus Hodges. The question is, how's he going to do it, and how are we going to raise potential roadblocks or potential things that he may want more than that?
Well, I think this is really frustrating to me, and I think it is kind of in the evil genius category. I think maybe these people realize that it's harder for us as liberals to fight against this when it's like, well, no, this was about standing. It's about, and there's a bunch of weird, you know, arcane legal concepts that only opening arguments listeners can understand and nobody else can, you know, like it's harder when they don't give us the easy, you know, court strikes down Roe v. Wade, you know, and then we march on the streets because we're furious. They've figured out, I think, that if they just kind of do death by a thousand cuts or death by some weird some weird cuts you don't understand, then it's going to be harder for us to organize against it.
I think that's right. And I would add on to that, that the current, right, focus group tested, stupid description of originalism, right? Yeah, judges just need to be umpires calling balls and strikes, right? It puts those of us who apply the ordinary method of jurisprudence and who favor sensible outcomes into a double bind, right? Because as you start to explain, right, that these are procedural rules that are having this particular outcome, right, the rejoinder back to that is, see, look, like all these liberals care about is what the outcome is, right? And we don't. We're just following the process. This is what the doctrine of standing is. And, you know, if these liberal judges want to, you know, convert the doctrine of standing just because they don't like the outcome we reach in this particular case, that shows you why we need originalist judge. I mean, like, that was super easy for me to do. And I just extemp that off the top of my head. And I think these people are morons, right? Like it really is the kind of double bind where every time where you take advantage of technicalities and you point and every time the other side points out that you're doing that, you accuse them of only caring about the outcome.
Yeah. When the rules are so complex that you're able to exploit and there's so many opportunities for you to inject your personal biases in there, it's not calling balls and strikes. It's just it's too complicated for that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like when there's all these moving parts and these ways that you can, you know, maybe, oh, err on the side of pro-life in this little thing. You know, it's impossible to call it just calling balls and strikes, it seems to me.
I think that's exactly right. It reminds me, on day one of law school in civil procedure, I've spoken fondly of my Civ Pro professor, Mort the Tort Horowitz. was a big influence on me. And Mort said, look, we're going to be reading, and we came in having read six or seven cases already, not knowing how to read cases. I've talked about the reason law school does that to you. And what Mort said was, hey, who found these cases kind of hard to read? Right? And a few people like sort of sheepishly put their hands up.
Yeah, nobody wants to admit.
Yeah, nobody wanted to do that. And he put his hand, and he's like, come on, put your hands up. They're hard to read. He's like, I want you to know this, right? Every case that goes to the Supreme Court, by and large, is a hard case, right?
Yeah.
If it's not a hard case, it doesn't get there, right? And the reason it doesn't get there is because these cases, and particularly now, like these cases settle. He's like, you're not going to find out. He's like, I just want you to keep this in mind throughout civil procedure because as a non-lawyer, you're coming in thinking like, oh, there's this clash and, you know, it's between plaintiffs and defendants and this. And he's like, The body of the law is often shaped by what's not there, right? And when something is so clearly one-sided, because we have a both sides pay their own way legal system, then those cases don't go forward. And if they go forward, they don't get appealed. And if they get appealed, they don't go to the Supreme Court. And if they go to the Supreme Court, right? Like it's just by definition, the fact that the case is before the Supreme Court is a pretty strong indicator. Yeah, you know, that there are exceptions, right? But is an indicator that it's a hard case. And so I would add that, right? Like that the idea that you could take a simplistic rule that like you could just call balls and strikes, like you can't do that in hard cases, right? Like it is, if we're going to stick with the baseball analogy, right? Like it's like when they show the you know, overhead tracker, right? And the ball is literally like right on the outside.
Yeah. It's got a couple pixels on the line. You're like, well,
yeah. Yeah.
You're not just calling balls and strikes. It's too hard
well,
for that.
Yeah. And how does that fall down, right? Like
fans
of the team that's pitching are like, well, obviously that's got to be a strike.
Right.
And fans of the team at the plate are like, well, obviously that's a ball. And, you know, and that's, I think, you know, the way in which that, you know, if we're going to stick with their analogy, like every case before the Supreme Court is low and outside, right?
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, we've gone 75 minutes and I'm abutting against another recording. So actually, we're going to have to call it here. But nice, long, juicy bonus episode for everybody. I'm not optimistic, but at least this wasn't the worst possible outcome.
Those are the two takeaways. Number one, wasn't the worst possible outcome. Number two, be vigilant. Be out there and look for procedural tricks in the coming terms, and you know, keep listening to us. We'll flag them for you. But those were the two sort of bottom line. I wanted to go through all of this, and I hope our patrons enjoyed the sort of deep dive, even if not necessarily the outcome.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much, patrons. We really appreciate you, and we're glad we could give you a little bonus and. Tune in on very, very soon for another episode because we're still releasing our, of course, regularly scheduled Tuesday episode, which was a lot of fun. So look forward to that. See you then.